Welcome to the Capital Insight Podcast with Jenny Kasson and Michelle Timmish, two capital raising experts on a mission to demystify and equify the world of investment for entrepreneurs and investors alike. Listen in as they sit down with fundraising veterans and share with you the success stories and cautionary tales of outside-the-box capital raising. This is Capital Insight.
Hi, everyone. It's Michelle Timmish here. I'm with my colleague, Jenny Kasson. Welcome to the Capital Insight podcast. It's great to have you here. Today, we're going to talk about step four in Jenny's six-step process for raising capital on your own terms. Step four can be a little bit intimidating because it's all about securities law and compliance, but we're going to try to give you a pretty good overview today. And don't worry, it took us absolutely years to understand the nuances of all this stuff. So don't be intimidated by the fact that it's confusing. You probably do want to find ultimately a lawyer to consult if you're looking to raise capital who understands this stuff. But, securities law dates back to the early 1900s. And it was actually the state of Kansas that was the first to adopt laws around selling securities. What was happening was the Kansas state legislature got wind of the fact that people from outside of the state, I think it was New York, had come to the state and were soliciting investments from people in Kansas for projects outside of that state. And the legislature got really, really concerned about that and decided in 1911 to establish the first securities laws prohibiting that. The federal securities laws then followed in 1933 and 1934 after the stock market crash in 29. And of course, by this time, many states had also been busy adopting their own securities laws. So now we have this body of law that we have to look at anytime we're looking at raising money from investors. So you might be asking, what is a security? So a security is actually defined really broadly, both from a federal standpoint and state legislator standpoint. It's essentially anytime you have a contract or a scheme in which someone invests in an enterprise and is led to expect profits from that effort from a third party, you have a security. So, Jenny, you were talking on our podcast about step three that we did, about people often getting confused about what type of investment falls into the definition of a security. What are some of your thoughts on that? Basically, everything's a security, but why?
Yeah, there's a lot of efforts to evade or avoid coverage by securities laws by saying like, oh, this thing I'm doing, I'm not offering a security. And that, you know, there's a long history of that. Like there is a famous case called the Howey case, which is a federal Supreme Court case where some people were growing orange trees and they were saying like, oh, you know, buy this orange tree, and then we'll pay you the returns from the sale of the oranges. And they were trying to pretend that that was not a security, but it was, because people are putting their money into buying this orange tree and then relying on the efforts of this company to sell the oranges and make a return on their investment in the oranges. So that's a famous case that says, look, you know, even if you're kind of disguising what you're offering and trying to make it look like it's not a security, if it meets this definition called the Howey test, it is a security. And basically that test is just, if you sell someone something and they're putting their money into it with the expectation that they're going to make a financial return on that investment, it's probably a security. And in the world of crypto and NFTs, that's been a big issue lately, because a lot of people want to say like, oh, I'm selling these tokens and they're really not securities. But if you look at how they're advertising it when they're selling it, obviously people are buying it with the expectation of making a financial return because they think it's going to increase in value. So it is a security, and there's lots of crackdowns happening right now at the state and federal level on those unregistered sales of securities where people, you know, sort of tried to act like they were not securities when they definitely did meet the definition of securities.
Yes, yes. And you did make the point too on that step three podcast about when we were talking about offering equity or debt, pointing out to people that both equity and debt are securities offerings. So we do see that too, where some people think that because they have some sort of debt instrument that it might not be a security. It's all securities. So yeah, the basic rule is that unless they're, and the reason securities laws are so important is because if you don't have an exemption that applies to your situation, then all offerings must be registered under federal security laws and state securities laws in which the offering is being made. That is incredibly burdensome. Think about, this is basically how the process of a company going through what they do when they're going public or doing an IPO. So that expensive process of registration is what we do, what we focus on finding an exemption so that we can avoid that process. It's not a fit for most businesses. So you're going to want an exemption from the registration process. And that's really what our work is involved in, is focusing on the different exemptions from registration requirements and helping clients choose one or more of the exemptions that fit their situation the best. When you're offering securities, you must identify a federal exemption and be sure and identify the state, the corresponding state exemption, where you want to make your offering. Jenny, tell us about the thinking behind these regulations to help people understand the perspective of the regulators just real quickly. Like, why do they care? Why do we even have these laws?
Yeah. So, you know, there have been situations where people have sold securities and it's caused like a big problem where a lot of people lost a lot of money because they invested in things they didn't understand. You know, so the idea behind securities regulations is they want to prevent large numbers of unsophisticated people from investing in big schemes where, like, there's a huge number of people that make investments, don't know what they're doing, lose their money, lose their life savings. So securities laws have some basic principles, and those principles are, number one, if you're publicly advertising the fact that you're raising money, there's a little bit more concern. There's more concern, not just a little bit, more concern on the part of the regulators. If you're publicly advertising something, there's a fear that it could be a more widespread offering, and if things don't go well, that more people could lose their money. So public advertising is something that is not always allowed under the securities laws, and you need to do special compliance stuff to be able to do that. Another thing is the concept of selling only to accredited investors. And an accredited investor, there's a long list of things that make you an accredited investor, but a very, you know, the basics are that if you're an individual, you have at least $1 million in net worth, not including your primary residence, or $200,000 in annual income regularly, not just a one-time thing. And so if you limit your securities offerings to people who meet that definition of an accredited investor, the regulations are going to be a little less onerous generally, because there's this belief that wealthier people are not, it doesn't create as big a risk when wealthy people invest in things that they might lose all their money because they can afford to lose it. And another principle is that if you're raising larger amounts, there it creates more potential risk. So there are exemptions for smaller raises. Small generally means like up to 5 million these days. It's gone up quite a bit. It used to be much less. But as long as you're raising less than 5 million, you have a lot of options. And then when you go above 5 million, your options start to diminish because there's a belief that the bigger the amount of money, the bigger risk it could pose to the, you know, economy as a whole, or, you know, large swaths of people.
Awesome. Thank you. So there are basically four questions that we like to say, if you can answer these questions, it'll be your guide in choosing your compliance strategy. So I'll list them and then we'll go back and talk about each one. So the first question is, do you want to be able to publicly advertise your offering? Do you want to limit your offering to accredited investors, the wealthy individuals that Jenny talked about, or do you want everyone? If there's only about 8% of the population, I looked this up recently, and it was actually 8.25% of the population of Americans is accredited. So when you limit yourself to accredited investors, you're limiting yourself to a very small segment of the population of the 100% that are eligible to invest. So something to keep in mind. The third question is, how much do you want to raise? The fourth question is, in what states are your potential investors located? Is it just one state, a few states, or all the states? So in looking, going back to these questions, number one, do you want to be able to publicly advertise your offering? This is something, and Jenny and I have used both public and private offerings, and there's no question that being able to publicly advertise your offering, tell everybody that you're raising money. We are currently raising money publicly for our economic development fund in Baltimore, and we can tell everybody all the time that we're raising money. There's definitely some advantage to being able to do that. What's the downside, Jenny, do you think, of when might you not want to do a public offering, or when might not that be something that's even, you know, critical to you to get the word out en masse?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think all things being equal, I wish we could always publicly advertise, because when you are allowed to publicly advertise, you can just relax a lot, like not worry like, oh my God, I accidentally said something in public that I shouldn't have said, or I accidentally told someone about this investment that I shouldn't have told, you know? So I think being able to publicly advertise is a great thing, even if you don't have the intention to, like, you know, shout it from the rooftops, like tell the whole world, announce it everywhere. Just knowing that you don't have that risk of accidentally saying something that you're not supposed to say in a context where you're not supposed to say it is so nice. But as we know, there are trade-offs. Being allowed to publicly advertise means there's probably going to be some other limitations on how you're allowed to raise money. You know, so for example, like the way Michelle and I are currently raising money, we are allowed to publicly advertise, but we have to make sure all of our investors are accredited. So it's a trade-off, you know. So I'd say in a perfect world, we could always publicly advertise, but oftentimes there will be trade-offs if you want to be able to publicly advertise.
Right. And so deciding a decision point, one of the other things, obviously, that is relevant when you're thinking about this is that limitation to accredited investors. Are you really interested in seeking investment from people who are not accredited? Do you want to invite regular people into your offering? Does that piece of it, bringing other people in that are not accredited, is that important to you? Is it important to your mission as a company? Is it important for the way you want to grow your company? The way you raise capital is very reflective of your company and its values. So deciding whether or not to limit yourself to the 8.25%, or whether or not you want to open it up to 100%. It's not the only question. There are other factors that influence these decisions, but it is something that you want to know whether or not you like this idea about opening up the investment to everyone, or you're just focused on more professional type investors or accredited investors. The other thing to consider is how much you want to raise. And Jenny, you said something about this earlier about the 5 million mark. So what is it about the amount that you raise that influences this question?
Yeah, so there's all these different exemptions that are available. And, you know, it's so complicated because you have to look at both federal and state. But in terms of federal exemptions, there's no federal exemption right now that has a cap lower than 5 million. So generally speaking, if you're raising up to 5 million, you have a lot of options. The more, if you're raising more, then it starts to get a little more limited. And there's another one where you can raise up to 10 million. So if you're raising more than 10 million, you get a little bit more limited. And then, of course, it's even a little more complicated than that. For example, there's a relatively new crowdfunding exemption in California. And if you use that exemption, you can only raise up to 300,000. So it really is going to vary based on your compliance strategy. But also, of course, as Michelle knows very well, because she runs a crowdfunding platform, even though you can raise up to 5 million using investment crowdfunding, the more you're raising, if you're raising more than 124,000, you have much more onerous requirements in terms of your financial reporting. So, you know, it's a little bit more complicated than just, oh, raise up to 5 million and it's easy. But, you know, it is just generally the case that the more you want to raise, the more regulatory hoops you're going to have to jump through and the fewer your options.
Exactly. Exactly. And that final thing, the fourth thing, is what states. It also sometimes, if you are in one state, for example, and you want to raise money and you know that all of your investors are also in that state, that can help define your compliance strategy as well. You might be able to do something a little more simple, less complicated, depending on where you think your investors might come from. So that consideration can really play a big role as well. Let's talk about the three categories of securities offerings. We've been talking about public, private, but really we're talking about a private offering that's open to both accredited and unaccredited, or only open to accredited investors. We've got public offerings that are only open to accredited investors, and we've got public offerings that are available to both accredited and unaccredited. And so just talk briefly, Jenny, about private offerings. You don't have to go into all four of the different private offerings. We might not have time for all of that, but you know, what do we need to know about private offerings in terms of how we talk to investors in particular?
Yeah, so private offerings generally are going to be like the easiest ones to do from a regulatory perspective because they are a little bit generally less regulated than a public offering. So what does a private offering mean exactly? Well, first of all, it does make it easier to include unaccredited investors. So that's one thing that's nice about private offerings. There, you can generally raise, you know, a fair amount of money and include both accredited and unaccredited investors, although there's often a cap on the number of investors or number of unaccredited investors. But private offering means that you don't publicly advertise in any way the fact that you're looking for investors. And even the most vague statement can be considered public advertising. Like if you were to put on your website, potential investors, click here for more information, that would definitely be a violation of the rules of private offering. So that's the thing that is yucky about private offerings, is you have to be so careful how you communicate the fact that you're raising money. And you really want to keep it to one-on-one private conversations. And depending on your exemption, there is one federal exemption where you can't really even tell someone that you're raising money at all unless you make sure they're accredited first. That's the rule 506B exemption. If you're not, you know, assuming you're not including, it gets super complicated. But basically, this is the very mainstream way of raising money that is done by kind of folks that are in that venture capital space. And what they'll do is they'll make, their lawyer will tell them you cannot talk to any unaccredited investors at all. So if you're not sure if someone is accredited, you actually have to give them like a questionnaire to make sure they're accredited before you even talk to them, which is very awkward, you know? So these are things about private offerings that are a little frustrating. Of course, there's another tool we use a lot where you don't have to do that, which is nice. But anyway, so that's what private means.
Right. And the point here, obviously, is that you have to pick a strategy, you have to pick a compliance strategy, but you have to know the rules that govern that strategy and follow them, because the last thing you want to do is blow your compliance and get yourself into hot water. So it's well worth working with an attorney who can help you figure this out. For sure. Then the next one is really a public offering open to accredited investors. This is what we were talking about a little earlier, the exemption that we are raising money under right now for our project in Baltimore. And that is Rule 506C. So we can tell the whole world that we're advertising, but that limitation of only being able to talk to accredited investors means that A, we have to figure out that each of our investors are actually accredited. We have to verify them, go through that step. And the other thing is we can't talk to people who are not accredited and can't bring them into our investment, which is something that, you know, we had to think long and hard about going with that type of exemption, because our whole philosophy is to include the 100%. But there are times when it just doesn't make sense to be able to do that. And yeah, so that's,
I wish we could, but it does, as we said, it, there's more hoops to jump through. And of course, we can talk to whoever we want because public advertising is allowed. But all of our investors, we have to make sure they're accredited. Yeah. And we do feel funny about that because we love being able to include everyone. But because of the trade-offs, we chose this option for this particular raise.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then, you know, one of the things that's very near and dear to my heart and Jenny's as well, because it does include the 100%, is the ability to have a public offering that you can advertise within restricted limits. There's limitations in how you can advertise using investment crowdfunding and offer these securities to both accredited and unaccredited investors. And, you know, how did this used to be done, Jenny? And it still in some cases is investment crowdfunding that's more on a state level.
Yeah, I remember when people were starting to talk about advocating for a federal investment crowdfunding law, and people would go around saying, it's illegal right now for regular folks to invest in small businesses, you know, outside the stock market. And I was like, no, it's not, because there actually were ways that it was done back then. And we did it ourselves many times, and we had clients who did it. But it was not easy. We had to do state level registrations. So some states were easier than others. I did state level registrations in probably, like, I don't know, 15 different states. And some of them were way easier than others, but each one had its own little quirks. And we had one client that actually raised in many, many different states and registered in all of them. And it's a hassle. Like, you had, it was hard. And then with California in particular, it was very, very onerous. It could take like up to a year to get through the process. So yes, it was absolutely possible to do investment crowdfunding back in the old days. But in 2016, we got our federal regulations, and now it is much, much easier. But as Michelle said, sometimes we still use those old state laws. And then there's even some new state laws that came into effect more recently. So for example, we just had a client who used interstate crowdfunding in Wyoming to raise a bunch of money from Wyoming residents. They did not use federal crowdfunding because they were just raising from Wyoming residents. And there was a law in Wyoming that actually was a lot easier to comply with than the federal law. So it just creates more options and more tools in the toolbox.
Right. And I think that, you know, before we go, I would like to talk a little bit about the federal crowdfunding exemption. There's a lot of myths out there about the ease with which you can raise money this way. And I think we should spend just a few minutes talking about the realities of investment crowdfunding, but also the notion that investment crowdfunding is a really powerful tool because it does allow participation in the finance ecosystem by the 100%. If you believe like we do that the number of zeros in your bank account should not determine whether or not you are somebody who can build wealth by investing directly in small businesses and startups, that this opportunity that investment crowdfunding brings to all Americans is unique. We haven't seen this since those days back in the early 1900s when we were seeing laws being implemented for the right purpose, right? Wanting to keep people from losing their life savings. But I think we went too far and we excluded regular people from investing directly in small businesses and startups, particularly those that they know and love and are in their communities, that we need to right that ship and find some balance. And investment crowdfunding is one of the tools that we have that's a great equalizer. But it's not without its burden. First of all, you have to be, and full disclosure, I run an investment crowdfunding platform, Crowdfund Main Street. So my bias for this exemption is high. And I admit that. So just to give an overview, let's talk a little bit about what you can and can't do. You can raise up to $5 million using investment crowdfunding. The biggest burden, I think, comes in this space from the fact that if you're raising more than $124,000, you need to have reviewed financials. And reviewed financials by an independent CPA, even if you're raising below or $124,000 or less, you still need to have certified financials that are GAAP compliant. So most companies are not keeping their books on GAAP compliance. It's not how we typically report for our companies. So even people who are raising below the threshold where you have to have reviewed financials often find they need a little support from a CPA. That's probably the biggest burden that we see. If you're raising more than $124,000, you can actually, if it's the first time you're raising, you can raise up to $1.235 million using those reviewed financials. After that, anything above $1.235 million, you need audited financials, or if you're doing it a second time. So the financial burden can be significant. And we like to tell people about that upfront and get them started on that process. It usually is the piece that takes the longest. The other requirement is that you will have to have an annual report. Typically, most companies just one annual report in the year following your raise. And I think the other sort of downside or negative it could be to think about if you want to use investment crowdfunding is the fact that you are providing a substantial number of disclosures to potential investors, as well as to the SEC. So for example, if you want to raise money using investment crowdfunding, all of your officers and directors are going to undergo background checks. Your entities are going to undergo a background check. Those things can be intimidating for some people. They don't like that idea. So that's something to consider. But all in all, we think that this exemption is worth it for all of the things that it can do for the real economy. And again, I think I didn't mention the fact that if you are looking to raise capital this way, you will need to use a regulated funding portal. And there are several, you can go to FINRA's website and actually see a list of all the authorized funding portals. But it is a good idea to do some investigating. It can be difficult from the sites alone to see the differences in the platforms. And this is something that kind of troubles me as the CEO of a platform. We're not really, we're pretty limited in what we can say, going back to what Jenny was talking about with regard to advertising. Portals are really limited in what they can say. We can't talk about anything in a way that might confuse someone into thinking we're giving investment advice. And even an emoji can be investment advice, if you ask FINRA. So we struggle to distinguish ourselves. It's one of the things that I think is the downside of this industry, is it can be very difficult to see what the different platforms are doing. But by and large, a lot of the platforms, the larger platforms, are of the ilk that venture style investing should be open to everyone, and that's the distinction that we have in Reg CF or investment crowdfunding. Whereas I tend to think about it as a true economic development tool that can help fund the other 99.9% businesses that are not high growth potential businesses. So that was a mouthful. What else, Jenny?
Yeah, no, I think one thing that I have noticed is sometimes when people are talking about how to different options for raising money, they'll say something like, well, you could offer equity, you could borrow money, you could do crowdfunding. And I think they're really confusing things. We think of it as two different decisions. One is what you're offering, and two is how you're offering it, meaning step four, like what is your legal compliance strategy? So you can offer equity, debt, convertible notes, saves, whatever you want, either through a private offering, through a Rule 506C offering, through an interstate crowdfunding offering, through a, you know, federal regulation crowdfunding offering. So don't think of crowdfunding as like a type of way to raise money. Just think of it as a choice of one possible compliance strategy. And it happens to be the one that gives you the most flexibility. But choosing what you're offering is a totally separate decision that we talked about in our step three episode. People just kind of sort of conflate different decisions as if they were in one decision, but it's really two decisions: what you're offering and how you're offering it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think it's the confusion is helped along a lot by the fact that there are some platforms that limit what you can offer. Mm. So it can be confusing, but there isn't anything that's a choice by the platform. That's not a law or a rule that applies to this type of offering. So good point there.
Yeah. Yeah. Regulation crowdfunding is just a compliance tool. It's an exemption, just like all these other exemptions. And legally, you can offer any type of security you want to. But of course, you definitely have to find a platform that fits your goals. And, you know, there are some platforms that won't let you offer equity, for example. So cool. Right. Well, I think this was a really good overview.
Yeah. Next up, step five. So thanks, everybody, for joining us. We really appreciate it. And we'll see you next time.
Do you have any questions for our securities lawyers and capital raising experts? Call the podcast hotline and leave us a message at 866-552-7726, extension 5. You can also send other inquiries to podcast@jennycassin.com. We'd love to hear from you. Music for the Capital Insight podcast is Still Searching by Damon Criswell via Audio Hero. Thank you for listening to Capital Insight with Jenny Cassin and Michelle Timmish. Until next time.